Hello and welcome to ESVS podcast. We are recording today live from Krakow, ESVS annual meeting. I'm Vaiva Dobrovolskaite, and today we will talk about genetic arthropathies and how genotype influences surgical decision making. I'm particularly excited about this topic and, to be quite honest, slightly intimidated too, as I feel I know too little about this. Today, however, I'm accompanied by a very experienced physician. Next to me is Dr. Gisela Tixidotura. She's a cardiologist specialized on cardiology imaging and aortic diseases. She is based at the University of Val Hebron, Spain. Yes. Maybe needs a correction. On the top of her clinical duty, she is active academically and was a part of writing committee of 2024 ESC guidelines for the management of peripheral arterial and aortic diseases published recently. Welcome to ESVS Podcasts.
Thank you, Maria, for having me here. It's a pleasure to be joined by you.
All right, so we have quite a topic to cover, and I will start with a small introduction. As we know, genetic mutations in arthropathies directly influence when and how surgery is performed. The decision-making process is highly individualized, considering not just aortic size, but the type of the mutation, associated risks, and family history. This genetic-based approach helps improve outcomes by minimizing the risk of aortic dissection, while also providing unnecessary or overly aggressive surgery. However, as vascular surgeons, we may sometimes focus on intervention rather than the whole picture. So may you say to me, what are your experiences in treating those patients and the importance of having a multidisciplinary team approach?
So thanks, baby. This is a crucial point and an interesting question, because the first point is to be able to diagnose patients with HTAD. And for this, all the specialized in patients can have this suspicion of the diagnosis. So knowing the red flags that might lead you to the diagnosis or the clinical suspicion is crucial. It is important to know how to come from the clinical suspicion to derive the patient, to send the patient to a specialized center for the confirming the diagnosis. In our center, for example, we receive patients from many different specialists, from vascular surgeons, of course, for cardiac surgeons, but also from ophthalmologists, internal medicines, that they have this kind of suspicion for the patients. The recent ESC guidelines, I encourage you to read them. They incorporate an algorithm when to suspect the diagnosis and when to send the patient to a center with expertise for the diagnosis. But I would stress the importance of the age factor first. So if you have a patient with an aortic disease and it's a young patient without cardiovascular risk factors, that's one red flag, I would say. Also, always ask the patient for family history of thoracic aortic disease. I think it should be part of the evaluation of any patient with aortic disease. Also detailing if it's a valve aortic disease, or it's a thoracic aorta disease or abdominal, so it has different implications for each one. And from here, and using also this kind of algorithm, you can decide whether or not to send this patient to a specialized center. And I think that's the crucial point, because we are for sure missing some diagnosis in these patients or arriving too late when there are the complications.
Yeah, and it's probably a good rule to be better safe than sorry, so better double check and call maybe, and maybe even over suspect than the other way around.
I always say this. I think that we wouldn't be doing well our job if all the patients were positive. I think we have to have some patients that we rule out the disease. That means that we have a good balance of suspicion.
Yes. And to avoid confusion, once more, I was thinking to introduce the terminology we're going to use throughout the podcast. It would be useful to talk about the group of conditions we aim to target in the talk. So what are the most common arthropathies with a genetic mutation that fall under the heritable thoracic aortic disease category, also called as HTAD?
Mm-hmm. So right now in this category, we incorporate diseases that are caused by one gene, so monogenetic disease, as far as we know. Of course, in the future, I'm sure that going to be polygenetic factors that influence the aortic disease or other environmental diseases. But in this case, now we are defining this by the presence of a gene variant that is related to thoracic or aortic disease. And this HTAD group is classically divided in two groups, what is a syndromic entities and non-syndromic entities. What means is that syndromic entities are the ones that have extra cardiovascular manifestations, musculoskeletal, ophthalmologic expression of the disease, that in many cases help us to suspect the diagnosis. In this part, we have the Marfan syndrome, that is the most frequent, the Loisdet syndrome, and the vascular EDS. But then there's this less known and I'm afraid less diagnosed group of patients that have a non-syndromic HTAD. These patients are suspect because are young, they don't have cardiovascular risk factors, and they have family aggregation of thoracic disease. So you have the suspicion of a genetic basis. And in those cases, we are identifying gene variants in around 30% of the cases. So we end up with 70% of the cases that we have the suspicion, but we are not really at this point being able to identify the causing gene variant. But even that, these patients need a proper follow-up, family screening. So it is a really more challenged situation, but it's really important to be identified.
And just to add a short additional comment, and all of those things probably, and further diagnosis is always done at a specialized center. And it's almost like one per country or only a few within the country, because those diseases are rare enough not to have.
I think every country or every region should plan how this is managed. I think there are differences in between countries, of course. But it is important that all the specialists know where to refer these patients, and know when they have the suspicion, send the patient. Maybe they come back without the diagnosis, that's fine, but at least we have the patient evaluated for this, and if it's needed, then followed at the referral center or the previous center.
Of course. And even though all of those conditions fall under the same category, guidelines do present a separate two recommendations with strong evidence, so class 1 level C, for individuals' medical management, which is sounds a little bit contradictory, but in simple words, I would like to stretch on a few things, so specialized evaluation and individuals' managements for basically all of those above-mentioned conditions. Could you a little bit elaborate on this?
We are now in the moment that we are beginning to have more information on each type of HTAD or each entity. But of course, many of these recommendations are level C. So you're going to see many of them are related to a consensus of experts. That's logical because these are low frequent entities. But we are trying to move forward and being really individualizing the indication for surgery, depending if it's a Marfan, it's a Loisdet or vascular EDS, or it's a non-syndromic entity, it's an actor too. So there are different situations where we can somehow individualize the treatment and the medical management.
And another aspect which is undeniably important for those conditions is genetic testing and family screening. Guidelines do present two class 1 level B recommendations on the issue, and one recommendation class 1 level C, which states that in patients with those conditions who have a pathogenic or likely pathogenic variant, cascade genetic testing at risk biological relatives is recommended regardless of age. Just to sum up, how we should proceed once suspected, when we should reach out to genetic testing. So just to draw a short scenario, as a vascular surgeon, you usually meet those people either already quite well diagnosed or unfortunately in a very emergent and urgent setup. So we have a patient with Marfan syndrome with a ruptured aortic aneurysm. We did make an operation, patient is stable, and in the morning I'm thinking, what should I do? Who should I call? Nobody knew from the relatives that he has a condition. Can you walk us through the steps of how we move forward?
Yeah, could be different scenarios. For example, the emergency situation, so then you have to act wherever the complication is. But you have to keep in mind that if it's a young patient and you see some syndromic features, that this patient could be genetic patient, like a Marfan patient. In general, a genetic test, it's not going to be next day result for sure. And it's a process where the patient gets counseled about about the expectation of the genetic testing and all the results for himself and for his or her family. So it has many implications, and it's a process that needs counseling, but also the results are not straightforward. It's not that you're going to get the result after. Even that, in an emergency situation, I think having into account that this patient looks like, or it's highly expect that it's going to be in an HTAD, might somehow, depends on the scenario, but might somehow change the implications for the surgery or for the intervention. But of course, there are different, very emergent situations that you have to go through. And you cannot.
And then how we move from this point to approaching the relatives. And so we got the positive Marfan syndrome, and how extensively we study the family. The patient has kids, for example, and how we move from there.
So from the first step is be sure, and this needs a geneticist, that the variant is really pathogenic or likely pathogenic. So it's classified as being not a benign variant, but a variant that can be causing the disease. So this is the first step. And when we have this information, then we can proceed to family screening. And this is what the guidelines were saying. It's a cascade screening. So where you begin with the father and mother, and also the son and daughter, and after that, if you get the mother or the father positive, then you go and expand the screening to the siblings and all the rest of the family. So it's not all the family altogether. It's just a procedure that it's progressive, and depending on the results that you get, and also every patient or every member of the family has to be counseled about the implication for each one.
And could you refresh our memories and remind us about the prevalence of different HTADs, as well as the likelihood for finding pathogenic variants within the family?
As a frequency, the prevalence, and the Marfan syndrome, that is the most recognized entity in HTAD, is just in the limit of the definition for a rare disease. It's one every 5,000, 10,000. So it's rare disease, but it's not as rare. So I would say that any cardiac surgeon, vascular surgeon, gonna face the situation during their professional life. But there are other entities such as Lyme disease. It's much, so it's not really well known first, but it is much less frequent, I would say, in our environment and our unit. We would say that for each Marfan, for every 10 Marfans, we have one Lois. It's like, this is our proportion, but that's absolutely biased, no? But as you can see, this is much less frequent. And even less frequent, it's the vascular EDS, that it's really a different scenario in many things. But you have to be really aware of these patients, because these are the ones that really gets a lot of complications.
Problematic. Yes. Okay, so you already touched upon the different variants and their likelihood. So I think naturally we will move on to go into a little bit more detail when we talk about all of those above mentioned syndromes. So let's start with the most common one, and probably something what most of us at least once saw in our careers already, is this Marfan syndrome. It's a mutation in the FBN1 gene, and Marfan syndrome is characterized by aortic root dilation, which can lead to aneurysm and dissection if untreated. It also affects other connective tissues, leading to oculoskeletal and cardiovascular manifestations. Maybe you can describe how does actually a typical Marfan patient looks like and other characteristics.
So from the extracardiovascular point of view, you're going to find some musculoskeletal features that are not constant. I mean, not all the patients have everything. That's one important point, because when you begin to see many Marfan patients, then you realize that not all are like the books are explaining. Yeah, so yeah. There's many different typical findings could be the musculoskeletal features with the tall, long arms and extremities, and also with problems like scoliosis or pectus deformities, also some area of the skin, ophthalmologic features such as, or affectations such as the lens dislocation, that is not the case for the Lois syndrome, and mesplanus, so there are facial appearance. So even that, there are some typical features, but then you're going to find patients that you won't say from the first time that it's a Marfan patient. So there's a spectrum of variability that for this, the genetic help us in really confirming the diagnosis. But also from the cardiovascular point, you said the aortic root, so it's the typical aortic manifestation of the Marfan. It's really frequent that during their life they're going to find this issue. It's really strange that it doesn't affect them during their lifespan. And now that we are doing elective surgeries in the aortic root in patients that are diagnosed and follow up, now we are beginning to see much more type B dissections in patients without previous dilatation, but that were operated for elective aortic root surgery. So now we are facing more complex cases every day.
Yeah. So I guess it's important to point out that it's a progressive disease, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And as you said, even though we do a surgery which is preventative of any emergent scenario, mm-hmm. eventually they do progress to either dissection or then an anastomotic aneurysm or any other issue. So it's naturally we're coming to the next question, which I also shaped in the sense that I think it's safe to say we are trying sometimes to prolong invasive treatment as long as we can with a good multidisciplinary team management, blood pressure management, and any other conservative measures. Well, we usually do reach the point, and unfortunately in quite young age for the patient, where the threshold is there and it's a red flag for us to intervene. What is the rule of thumb when treating, well, maybe not even only Marfan syndrome, but in general with those conditions, because they are quite close to each other? And then maybe we can discuss what we have actually in the literature to support the treatment methods and intervention time.
It is better known for what is the aortic root and the aortic root dilatation, especially for the Marfan patients. So it's better described the relation between the aortic diameter and the risk of having an acute aortic event. The guidelines, there's thresholds for indication of surgery for Marfan, and also for Lois Dietz at lower thresholds. For Marfan, could be at 50 millimeters as in general, then could be before at 45 when there are other high risk features such as progressive dilatation, family history of aortic dissection or in lower diameters. For Lois Dietz, it could be at 45 and even lower when there are other risk markers. Less is known and it's not defined anywhere, the thresholds for vascular EDS, because in fact there are dissections without dilatation, so it's a much more complex case, and also because there's a high risk for the surgery in this patient. We also don't know as much for the dilatation of the aortic arch and the descending aorta. The recommendations are set at 50 millimeters. This is an expert consensus in general. I could say in general this is in the form of a residual type B dissection or a type B dissection that has been progressively dilated, and you end up having this 50 millimeters is where you have to make a plan for the patient for intervention. That could be more than one stage of operation, no? Because you get to the aortic arch and then you do a elephant trunk, and then so it's the same, but then a second time it's going to be a thoracoabdominal. So you face a really complex path that has to be planned with all the team, the cardiologist, of course the vascular and the cardiac surgeons, but also the anesthesiologist and all the team to see what's going to be the next steps for the patient.
And I think it's also an interesting point to mention the treatment of the condition, open versus endovascular. So historically everybody still uses the phrase about golden starter being an open surgery because of the, let's say, a quality of the vessel wall which is not good enough for endovascular treatment because we know it will progress. However, I think we see more and more this as an issue raised in many podiums and as a discussion point that we actually do not have literature. Is it actually worse than an open? Because there is no randomized controlled trial. There's no big data on that. And I hope there's going to be smart research teams or teams ups to actually see how we should progress, because those are young people and they get so many procedures. They are heavy procedures. And at the end of the day, maybe we don't know. What is your opinion on that? Because literature is clear on that in a sense, but it's quite outdated, I feel.
As you said, there's no high evidence coming from clinical trials or not even long series of patients, because I think it's difficult that you're going to have it at any point. The classical, and this is also in the guidelines now, the recommendation is to favor open surgery in these patients. It's true that in an emergent situation or a situation that you cannot think about doing an open surgery, of course, it's an option. You have to have an open mind of that. Also, there's a scenario where we had this safe proximal landing zone, also a distal one, because if it was a previously operated patient. So that's one scenario. I think that it's reasonable to go for a neurovascular, but I think there's no evidence for that. And the non-operable patients, because these patients are getting older, comorbidities, and you cannot afford an open surgery in many cases.
Yes. Or some sort of hybrid options or bridging options. Okay, let's move on to Lewis D syndrome. So it's a more aggressive form of HDED. Lewis D syndrome is caused by mutations in TGFBR1, R2, and SMAD3, or TGFB2. It is associated with a higher risk of aortic aneurysms and dissections, even at smaller diameters, and it does affect multiple arterial segments. Would you describe those patients and then how we approach them?
So some of the patients might have similar phenotypical features to Marfan. In general, they are not as tall as the Marfan patients. Absence of lens dislocation. So if it's lens dislocation, you have to think about Marfan patient. Also the bifitubula, so it's not a pathologic thing, but it is something that supports or make you think more on Lewis D's patient. And also, although in Marfan we have described the presence of peripheral arterial aneurysm also, it is much more common and much more aggressive in Lewis D's patients. So the tortuosity of the arterial branches and peripheral aneurysm are more frequent and more aggressive, that in many cases they need intervention. Also intracranial aneurysm, so it's a myriad of aortic and vascular involvement. And also, as you say, the aortic involvement is in general more aggressive than in Marfan patients.
What about vascular Ehlers-Danlos syndrome?
This syndrome is much less known for many specialized, but I think especially for vascular surgeons, it's something that we have to be aware of, because it's a high risk, really high risk patient. I would say that is the most important one that you rule out if you have any fragility of the tissue or some family history. It's a young patient. The most important thing at the beginning is to be sure that it's not a vascular EDS. It's caused by a mutation in collagen 3A1. It's one of the genes and it needs confirmation by geneticists. The issue here, so their life expectancy is really shortened by the disease. Complications mean survival for around 40 years. So it's really, really aggressive. It has some difference in between male, female, and type of mutation, but in general, it's really aggressive. And the problem is that you can have complications even without dilatation. We don't know the thresholds for intervention, and we know that there's a high risk of intervention itself, because it's an issue that it's really frail and it's really difficult to operate on. So, but I think the diagnosis is crucial. And yeah, decisions are really difficult in these patients.
So now let's move on to a little bit more unknown for myself. Familiar thoracic aortic aneurysm and dissection is a group of conditions, and it's affected by mutations in genes like ACTA2, MYH11, this non-syndromic HTAD. It presents with thoracic aortic aneurysms and dissections without the systematic features seen in the syndromic conditions like Marfan's or Lewis D's. So how do we find them and what do we do with them?
The suspicion comes from clinical things such as the age of presentation. I would say this is the first red flag, but also the family history, especially thoracic aortic disease. But of course, you have to exclude the presence of systemic syndromic features. But at this point, when you have a young patient with family history, with aortic disease, you're going to send it to the geneticist for evaluation. They're going to make a panel of genes that includes also the fibrillin 1, so the Marfan. They're going to do all the panel. But I think it's crucial that we have this, all the specialists, we have this suspicion to try to diagnose them. In this situation, we can identify a gene in around 30% of the cases, so it's not really frequent. but even the ones that are not identified have to be followed, the proven case, but also the family, in a specialized center or in a center that is aware of this disease, even if it's still not identified the gene. So sometimes ago we only identified the 20% of the cases. Now we are getting a little bit better. We hope that in some years we are even better to identify these cases.
So I feel a bit better that I was not so aware of it, because it's so rare, but still we have to be cautious about that. Turner syndrome. It's usually females with Turner syndrome have a predisposition to aortic rotation and thoracic aortic aneurysms. What do we need to know about this?
In this case, the syndromic features are different. It's caused by exactly the absence of one of the X chromosomes. We're going to have a short stature, some clinical features that can give you the suspicion. In terms of cardiovascular, it is high frequency of coartation and thoracic aortic aneurysm, but also the presence of bicuspid aortic valve.
You already touched upon a little bit about bicuspid aortic valve associated arthropathy. So individuals with these conditions are at increased risk as well for aneurysms and dissections, especially in thoracic aorta, due to the abnormal hemodynamics related to the valve structure, though not all cases are genetically linked. How do we approach this condition?
Bicuspid aortic valve is much frequent in the population, so it's around 2% of the population. When we have diagnosed a bicuspid aortic valve, we have to study by transthoracic echo all the aorta that we can see with the echo, also evaluate the valve function, because they can have an insufficient or an aortic stenosis. And after that, it's recommended to study all the aorta by CMR or CT to see really all the aorta, the coexistence of a coartation, because it is associated with bicuspid aortic valve. And depending on the findings, of course, you have to follow them depending on the valve function, the aortic disease that you have. But of course, these patients have to be followed. Importantly, I would say there's this family screening of the first degree relatives. So it is not like the Marfan that you have autosomal dominant errancy, but there's a higher frequency on the first degree relative of having a bicuspid aortic valve. Around 6-7% of the first degree relative can have a bicuspid aortic valve. So you have to discuss this with the family, especially when there's an aortic root dilatation. And also keep in mind that even if it's a bicuspid aortic valve, you can have a Marfan patients, because bicuspid aortic valve is frequent. So, but you can have the coexistence of both, even more frequent Loisdet syndrome. So don't forget to ask for family history, syndromic features, even if it's a bicuspid that you think it is the cause of the aortic dilatation.
We are reaching the end of our podcast, but before that, I wanted to summarize all of these complex things we talked about. So these conditions require lifelong monitoring, as they significantly increase the risk of aortic rupture and dissection. And it is important to know how to suspect them and then therefore move to the genetic testing, multidisciplinary management, follow-up, and probably discussion as well within the team. Would you like to add some final remarks?
Yeah, I think we have discussed this, but also being aware, having into the mind that there's the possibility of having an HTAD. I think it's crucial for the vascular surgeons and all the surgeons that are treating aortic patients.
Definitely. I wanted to thank you so much for spending time with me to talk about this. I hope you're enjoying the time in annual meeting. This topic was challenging for me, but it's much clearer now, and I think our listeners feel the same way. I wanted to wish you a nice rest of the conference, and thank you for making time for this.
Thank you to you for having me.
Bye.